delighted to welcome you all to our two oral arguments today. We have with us students from Horning High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with a program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. This program is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the students come, they're set materials about the case. They're invited to come, listen to an oral argument, and meet with a justice of the court who is assigned to meet with the students that particular day. Before you go, Tina, just one moment. If anyone needs a summary of the case, would you raise your hand? We have summaries that you may have. Okay, thank you. The meeting with the students in justice comes after the second oral argument, and the subject of the meeting will be the procedures of the court in taking the case, deciding the case, mandating the opinion. The subject will not be substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice, including counsel. Now that we've met you, let me introduce the group that's sitting on the bench that has come today. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rokensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the students today. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to Justice Bradley's right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call our first case for today, 10 AP 2801 CR, State versus Michael. Is it Frey or Fry? Fry. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Fry is Assistant State Public Defender Devin M. Lee. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. As Justice Abrahamson mentioned, my name is Devin Lee. I represent Michael Fry.
We're going to have difficulty hearing you, so you'll have to raise the podium. There's a button on your right. Thank you. We are a high-tech court, Ms. Lee. Thank you. And then speak into the microphone. The acoustics in this room is leave something to be desired.
Thank you. My name is Devin Lee. I represent Michael Fry in this case. In the recent Court of Appeals decision in State v. Wesley, Judge Brown asked the question, what does dismissed outright mean anyway? That question should have an answer. And what the answer to that question should be is the issue before the court today. Some prosecutors, defense attorneys, defendants, and courts already believe that dismissed outright, when it's dismissed as part of a plea agreement, means that the charge will be disregarded at sentencing. There's a valid reason for this. It makes sense. If the state wants the court to consider a charge at sentencing, it will offer a plea agreement in which it gains a guilty or no contest plea from a defendant in exchange for agreeing to request a dismissal but read-in of a particular charge. By statute, a read-in is one that the defendant agrees to have the court consider at sentencing. If a defendant is unwilling to have a court consider a particular charge at sentencing, the defendant need not accept such a plea agreement and instead will proceed to trial.
Well, had he gone to trial and been acquitted on that charge, could the judge consider it at sentencing for the other charges?
I think that the difference, there's an important distinction between a charge that's dismissed via acquittal at the end of trial and a charge that's dismissed outright as part of plea negotiations. That distinction is, in large part, the reliability of that charge. When a charge is dismissed at the end of a trial or a defendant is acquitted of a particular charge, the court has had the opportunity to hear the evidence presented, and although the state may have failed to prove a particular offense beyond a reasonable doubt, it doesn't mean that the court can find that the facts underlying that charge are reliable by some lower standard. And, of course, things at sentencing need not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Could the court consider testimony heard at a preliminary hearing, evidence at a preliminary hearing?
I think that that's troubling as well, for the reason that the purpose of a preliminary hearing is to establish something to the level of probable cause. It's such a low standard. And at a preliminary hearing, a defendant does not challenge the reliability or credibility of any particular witness.
But at trial, a defendant who challenges the credibility or reliability of a witness and is found not guilty, the judge can still consider that testimony. The judge can still consider those facts, but you're saying that a preliminary hearing, the judge can't consider that evidence and testimony and weigh what those witnesses under oath said?
I think it's very difficult for a sentencing court or a trial court to determine the credibility of a witness at a preliminary hearing where that credibility has not been challenged and after a forum in which credibility is not supposed to be challenged. I mean, many defendants...
So how would you have us write that? A judge can rely on information that's derived from a not guilty verdict or an other act that's not admissible at trial or other incidents that never were in front of that judge, but a judge can't consider testimony heard at a preliminary hearing. How do we write that?
I think that the simple answer, the clear answer, is simply to hold a bright-line rule that when a charge is dismissed outright as part of a plea agreement, the court does not consider that charge or the facts underlying that charge at sentencing.
I understand that's what you want. I just wondered how we reconcile that as somehow less, somehow different than the other things that judges certainly can and do consider, including statements of victims and statements of people who just, including statements of the defendant that aren't somehow testified to. Defendant's family members say all sorts of extraneous things, and judges can consider those. But a charge that's charged in a complaint for which there's police reports and investigation, for which the defendant cuts a deal, or the state decides it can't prove to beyond a reasonable doubt, that should be the one niche that's carved out that a judge can't consider.
I do, and I think in part that's because the state has so much control over whether it even initially offers a plea agreement in which it agrees to request dismissal outright of a particular charge. In other words, I think that the court can certainly inquire into and often does, why is this charge being amended? Why is this charge being offered to be dismissed? I need to understand, in order to properly exercise my discretion, why this plea negotiation has taken place. And oftentimes, the state has discovered, perhaps in preparing for trial, that it has a witness it does not want to put on, or that it doesn't need that conviction, or for whatever reason. And obviously, the sentencing court and the court taking the plea can inquire into that.
Okay, but if the state decided not to charge that in the first instance, and then you went to sentencing on the same counts, the state could introduce that. The exact same thing. It's just when it's dismissed outright that you would say it can't be considered. But
yes.
If it's never charged at all in any document, then you're saying the judge can consider it.
And I recognize it's sort of a quirky rule that we're proposing. And the reason for that is only because I think to hold otherwise makes the meaning of dismissed outright unworkable. I think it makes it too unclear, because I think that the common sense definition of dismissed outright means that the parties assume that it will be disregarded. I mean, the rule that we're proposing today avoids the issue that the Court of Appeals identified in State v. Wesley, which was that the prosecutor thought that dismissed outright meant one thing, the defendant thought that dismissed outright meant another thing, and the sentencing court thought that dismissed outright meant something completely different. The Court of Appeals in that case said that the plea agreement was hopelessly ambiguous to them. That's what we want to avoid. We also want to avoid what happened in this case, which is that the prosecutor, the defendant, and the PSI writer all seem to assume that dismissed outright meant it would not be considered. No one mentioned it. But then the court obviously thought that it could discuss it because it discussed it at length during its sentencing remarks. So I suppose the court could come up with some alternative definition for dismissed outright. But I think that having a clear definition that if the state moves to dismiss a charge outright and the sentencing court exercises discretion and allows that plea agreement to go forward, that everyone is agreeing or acknowledging that the dismissed outright charge will not be considered at sentencing. Again, the state need not offer such a thing. Wisconsin is unusual, I guess, in that we have this statutory read-in procedure. So there should be some clear distinction between a read-in offense and a dismissed outright offense.
Counselor, but when a charge is read in, then there's not further prosecution. But when a charge is, quote, dismissed outright, the state is free to bring it up at another time, correct?
I disagree.
Oh, I think the case law says otherwise.
I think what the case law says is that when the state enters into a plea agreement, which is a contract with the defendant in which it agrees to dismiss outright a charge, that due process requires that the state uphold its end of the contract. And if the state came back another time and reissued that double jeopardy would prevent that from being pursued, and it would also be a violation of the plea agreement.
Well, I think that you're going to encounter case law that is different than what you suggest. And I don't think jeopardy attaches generally until some other kind of formal process has begun. I don't think it attaches by the filing of a complaint. So your understanding is just very different from mine.
You're distinguishing between dismissals and dismissals on a plea agreement.
Absolutely. Because of the contract piece, I think that creates a meaningful distinction.
So this is a freedom of contract case?
Sure. I mean, I think in some ways it is, because it's based on, the party, there has to be a meeting of the minds when we're talking about a contract and when we're talking about a plea agreement. I mean, in order to enter into a knowing voluntary plea, the defendant must know what he or she is pleading to and what he or she is gaining.
Then why isn't he moving to withdraw the plea? If you're saying it's a breach of the plea agreement, essentially, because things were considered that shouldn't have been considered.
I don't think there was a breach of the plea agreement here. I think that the parties entered into a plea in which the state offered to have Mr. Fry plead to certain charges and agreed to move to dismiss outright other charges. The state upheld its end of the bargain.
Okay, stated differently. You're saying he didn't know. When he entered this plea agreement, he didn't know that the court could use this. So he wants to withdraw the plea because he didn't knowingly, freely, and voluntarily enter this plea, knowing this evidence could be used against him. Why isn't that your motion?
In hindsight, I certainly could have and probably should have litigated it that way.
Well, counsel, in the plea colloquy, isn't he told that the court is not bound by the plea agreement?
Absolutely.
Not bound to disregard? He's not bound by anything. It's totally discretionary with him.
Not bound to disregard means something different to me than not bound to dismiss. I think the problem that we have is the sort of common everyday meaning of dismissed outright means something to certain defendants that maybe it doesn't mean. There's no requirement, in other words, that anyone tell the defendant, as it must with a read-in, this is going to be considered at sentencing, you're agreeing to have this considered at sentencing, you may be ordered to pay restitution for this. With a dismissed outright, the defendant is told nothing. The defendant is not told that the court may consider this in determining whether this was an isolated event or a series of events, and that it relates specifically to character, which is one of the three factors the court must consider. And so I think that not bound by the plea agreement doesn't necessarily convey to a defendant what that means. Mm-hmm. If the that doesn't disabuse a defendant of maybe the misconception that, well, the charge has been dismissed outright, as long as that's done, yes, I understand that the court isn't bound by any sentencing agreement that the state and the defendant have entered into, that, you know, you can be sentenced up to the maximum for the crime for which you've been convicted. And so I think that the problem with the current state of the law with dismissed outright, especially when we're talking about when it's dismissed outright in exchange for a guilty or no contest plea to another charge, is that it's not well defined. And if this court is unwilling or unable to reach, is unwilling to adopt the rule that we're recommending today, that is that dismissed outright means it will not be considered, I think that the court, I would respectfully request that the court come up with a rule that at the very least provides notice to a defendant or requires the court to inform a defendant what the use of dismissed outright charges can be.
I think that should be part of the colloquy.
I do. And I think it should be comparable to a read-in. I mean, I guess it's what I think I have a hard time wrapping my own mind around with this is that we have a read-in offense, which is read-ins are sort of a very limited purpose, limited by statute. You know, they can be considered at sentencing. They can't increase the maximum penalty, but they certainly can be taken into consideration. The defendant has to agree to have that taken into consideration. The defendant can be ordered to pay restitution for a dismissed but read-in offense, and the defendant will receive sentence credit under State v. Floyd for read-in offenses. But with a dismissed outright, which I think to most of us sounds better than a read-in from a defense point of view, I think you're getting more. There's no explanation for what that means or how it will be used.
How does your theory square with victims' rights? I mean, if you're saying that something is dismissed outright and cannot be considered by the court, would that preclude the victim from coming in at a sentencing hearing and say, this is exactly what happened to me, and I want this to be taken into account?
I think there would be a conflict there, and I think that potentially it would need to be disregarded. And that does create a conflict with the victim rights. And one of the issues there is that that may be a circumstance where the state does not offer to dismiss outright a charge involving a victim who wants to be able to speak. I mean, that's where, under certain circumstances, if a defendant understands, you know, this is what's going to happen, and the state understands this is what's going to happen, and the court understands this is what's going to happen with a read-in versus a dismissed outright charge, everyone can make a knowing decision as to what gets done. I mean, the state is in control at the outset of deciding what charges it will agree to move to dismiss, what charges it will agree to move to dismiss but read in, and which charges it will not offer any concessions on.
And what should we do with Elias versus State? And why didn't that put your client on notice?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Why didn't that put your client on notice? In that, the court said, the court can consider dismissed charges. That's been around for 22 years.
It has been
more than that. It's been around for 32 years.
And that obviously is the case that is in some ways most problematic here, but in other ways is not. I mean, the facts of Elias are interesting. And I think that the court, when it wrote its decision in Elias, was careful to note that that was a case in which the defendant was charged with a number of crimes, I believe 6 crimes. He pled to one, which I think was possession of controlled substance. I think 5 other charges were dismissed outright. One of those was possession of heroin. The defendant appealed, arguing that the sentencing court talked about this heroin use as an aggravating factor, or at least a showing that there was no mitigating factor as to the heroin. This court, in deciding that case, said it can consider dismissed outright charges in determining whether we're talking about an isolated event, in other words, whether there really was one act, or whether this is a particular defendant who has engaged in a pattern of behavior. And this court noted the fact that this was a defendant who admitted, whose own witness at sentencing talked about the defendant's heroin use, that there was the defendant himself admitted that he had a problem with heroin, and that there were, you know, sort of all kinds of evidence presented during that hearing that the defendant had a heroin problem, and that the court had not relied on that dismissed outright charge for finding that he had heroin, but that there was a lack of mitigating circumstances. And I think that's very different from the fact scenario presented in this case, where the sentencing court did not use the dismissed outright charge to say, well, this isn't an isolated event, we have a pattern here, but rather focused on the substance of the charge, which this court in Elias noted had not happened. And I think the way that we get around Elias is simply to say that Elias stands for the proposition, or has for the last 30 years, that dismissed outright charges can be considered in determining whether it's an isolated act or a pattern.
Well, isn't that your second argument? Namely, if the court doesn't buy your legal proposition, dismissed charges mean can't consider it at sentencing. Your alternative argument is that, okay, they can be considered, like acquittals, like other evidence, other acts evidence, like hearsay in the PSI about unrelated incidents, etc. But that the rule of law in this state is that it's considered for character or pattern of activity, not considered in terms of the nature of this offense and, therefore, the sentencing on the nature of this offense. That's your second argument. Then it fits in with Elias and fits in with a whole series of other cases.
It does. And I think, you know, I guess part of the issue and part of the basis for my second argument, and again, the distinction in my own mind between charges that are dismissed outright sort of at the outset, is that they're less reliable than a charge that's dismissed as part of an acquittal.
But that's true of other acts evidence and a lot of hearsay. When I say hearsay, a lot of people who talk to the preparer of the PSI and say all sorts of things about the background of the person, what acts he committed, what they saw and didn't see, and there's no cross-examination of them. But at sentencing, the defendant is given an opportunity to say this just is not true, or whatever the defendant wants to say, right?
Yes, and that's a key distinction between what you're saying and what happened here, because when it arises in the context of a PSI, when it's arisen in the context of testimony at trial where there's ultimately acquittal, the defendant knows walking into sentencing what's going to be considered because it's in the PSI. This would be a very different case if the PSI had discussed at length the charges that had been dismissed. And it wasn't just the sexual assault charge. There were some other charges that were dismissed that are less significant for our purposes. But if the PSI had done that, the defendant would have had notice that this could be considered. I mean, this case, I think, highlights the flaw in the current law, hole in the current law, which is that a defendant, in order to have a meaningful opportunity to be sentenced properly, should know what's going to be considered. And the problem with our not having any guidance to courts on how to use a dismissal is that the defendant has no way of knowing. And I, you know, I'm a former trial attorney, and I work with many trial attorneys now on appeal, and I can tell you anecdotally that I don't know how many defense attorneys or courts tell defendants, this is being dismissed, but it will be used to determine your character. And I don't know how many cases would be affected if the defendant had that knowledge. Either the defendant might not enter into a plea or might take a different tack at sentencing. And that piece, which I think is fundamental, is just missing in our law, and it obviously had an impact in this case.
The concept that the defendant have some notice, knowledge, opportunity to set the record straight so that the sentencing is determined on, or at least the judge has the opportunity to determine sentencing on correct information. I mean, that's endemic in the cases, that concept. The question is, to me, twofold. One, is this view of the judge's view of the dismissed case relevant? And two, is it the kind of matter that the defendant should have notice of so that the defendant can respond? Now, you put notice into the first argument at the plea colloquy. Of course, that's pretty early for the judge to have made any kind of view about using it. So now we're at sentencing, and the judge has in his own mind come to the sentencing, and he has some ideas of what he's going to do or she's going to do, and is thinking that he's going to use this dismissed count. What should the judge do, in your opinion?
Ideally, I think the judge would inform the defendant what the judge is thinking about considering.
Okay.
But I guess I wonder whether this court would see it more as, you know, where the court has never held that if the court is intending on, for example, going out over and above a sentencing agreement, need not tell the defendant. I think the difference here, again, is in that case, the defendant's already been told at the time of plea that the judge isn't bound by the plea agreement. So it's sort of inherent in the Hampton warning. Whereas here, there's nothing inherent in a plea agreement where a case is dismissed outright that the judge will consider it.
Why at sentencing the judge says, you know, I'm going to consider this, and why can't the defendant say, or the defense counsel say, what was heard at preliminary hearing was not totally accurate, or what you have just said about is not accurate, just as he would in a PSI?
Well, again, that presumes that the attorneys have some sense of what's going to be said. You know,
if the court rules that the judge can consider a dismissed count, the defendant is going to know from now on.
Right, and I think that would in some ways cure what happened here. I mean, here in part was the lack of notice, which again goes to what Justice Ziegler was saying, was why didn't he withdraw his plea? I think we'll probably pursue that at a later date with me on the stand, but sorry, you know, I'm an advocate, so but I, you know, I think at the end of the day, what makes sense is to have the court hold that a dismissed outright charge when it's part of a plea agreement means it can't be considered. I don't think that's wholly inconsistent with Elias. I don't think it's wholly inconsistent with the jurisprudence of the
counsel. Your red light's on. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. And one issue you haven't touched is assuming the court's going to hold against you on the other two, then your argument is that the judge went too far
and how he considered or she considered these dismissed charge. I'd like you to address that, please.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thomas J. Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to begin my argument by addressing what I see in retrospect as a really weak part of my brief, and that is the part of my brief that's down at the bottom of page 4, going into page 5, and that's the whole issue of what, if anything, does a defendant, quote unquote, admit when he agrees to have charges read in pursuant to a plea agreement. I slipped over that. I did not adequately address it. I did not say in my brief what I should have said and what I meant to say, so I would like to correct that.
Mea culpa,
mea maxima culpa. I used to say that when I was an altar boy all the time.
This is not a read-in case, but that's okay. This is not a read-in case, but you can correct your brief.
Yeah, I want to correct my statement as to what a read-in case.
We had a case that said that isn't an admission. Go ahead. That was the whole case.
I didn't adequately address your holding in Strzokowski, a case which I cited numerous times in my brief. I didn't adequately address your holding in that case that the defendant does not admit guilt.
That's right.
Does not admit guilt.
That was the issue in the case.
I'm sorry?
That was the whole issue in that case.
That was the whole issue, and that was your clear holding, and I did not adequately address it in my brief. While it is true, and I want to start out by saying I have absolutely no quarrel with your holding in Strzokowski. I think it was absolutely correct. The defendant does not admit guilt when he agrees to a read-in charge. But nevertheless, there is, as I will phrase it today, an element of admission when a defendant agrees to a read-in charge. There has to be an element of admission to distinguish a read-in charge from a charge that is not read in. And that's how I define dismissed outright, by the way. Dismissed outright means not read in. There has to be this element of admission to distinguish the two types of cases, because otherwise a dismissed charge and a read-in dismissed charge mean the same thing. They can be considered in the same way by the sentencing court.
Well, isn't there a difference in regard to the fact that when you use a case, when you use a charge as a read-in, it will not be prosecuted on later?
That's one, but I mean for sentencing purposes, there are collateral effects of a read-in charge. But I'm limiting my argument here to using it for sentencing purposes, and the difference, I believe, is that a read-in charge has more weight and can be considered and can be given greater weight by the sentencing court in formulating a sentence, because the judge can be more assured of the reliability of the facts underlying that crime by the fact that the defendant agrees to have it read in. And that's what I mean by an element of admission. Not that the defendant admits that he did it, but let me read to you what I have written out as the correct way to phrase it and how I should have phrased it in my brief. That when a defendant agrees to have a charge read in, he is agreeing that the sentencing court can treat this read-in charge as though, and those are the critical words, as though it had been admitted. It's not admitted, but it can be treated as though it had been admitted for the purpose of establishing the reliability of the underlying facts and determining the weight that the court can give that charge in sentencing.
See if I can state it a different way, and you'll agree or not.
if there's a read-in,
yep,
then in imposing the sentence on the admitted charge or the proved charge, the defendant can consider the read-in charge in sentencing for the convicted charge. So if the charge has a 10-year, if the conviction is a 10-year potential sentence, you can consider the read-in and imposing the sentence for that convicted charge directly. When there is not a read-in, you don't consider it for that particular charge. You consider it generally for his character or pattern of conduct.
I would not agree with that.
Okay, that's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I would.
Why not?
That's the second.
That's the defendant's position, right?
That's the second part of their argument, and I don't agree with that at all.
Tell us how you treat a read-in for sentencing different than dismissed. Or maybe you don't.
It is not treated differently in kind. It's treated differently only in degree, because all dismissed charges are not equal in terms of their reliability. I mean, we go back, we can have charges that have been dismissed that never got past the complaint stage. We have charges that, as in this case, went through the preliminary hearing stage. And all of these dismissed charges, all of going beyond just dismissed charges, all uncharged offenses have different degrees of reliability depending on
an acquittal.
On the facts. Acquittals have another degree of reliability. Mm-hmm. So this goes to the weight, the reliability of the allegations or the facts underlying this other offense, go to the weight that a court can properly give this other offense in the sentencing. Now, if you have another offense that is nothing more than hearsay that has never been charged, for example, that has never been assessed for probable cause, that has very low reliability. It has very low weight, and the judge probably should not give it a lot of weight in formulating the sentence. A charge an offense that has been charged, that has been reduced to writing in a complaint, and where a judge has found probable cause for the complaint, that's a little more reliable. If it goes through the preliminary hearing where you actually have testimony, that's more reliable still. That finding of probable cause is even more reliable. But you still have a problem, because there is no actual adjudication of guilt. There's no actual admission of guilt. So there still is a question about reliability for all of these offenses.
Counsel, let me tell you my problem in part with this case and in listening right now. I start with the premise, and I think I wrote the note at the very beginning of this oral argument. The law and procedure have to make sense.
It definitely does. We agree on that.
It has to make sense. Sometimes what my idea of common sense is may be different than another person's idea of common sense, so I'm aware of that. But it has to make sense. And what I hear you're saying, first of all, there has to be an analysis. It's not a difference in kind, but only reliability. So I think, okay, we're going to slice and dice, is it kind and reliable? And then I hear you talk about what brings to my mind a writing of this court that talks about all the different degrees of probable cause, and you're familiar with that writing, you know.
I am certainly familiar with that, yes.
You, I know we all. And it is nuanced. I think that's a fair way to, you know. This is bread and butter. This is every day in a circuit court in Trempealeau County and in Shawano County, and defendants come in, and they're going to have charges dismissed but can be used for read-in at purposes of sentencing. That's what they're told oftentimes. That's right on the record.
And then in a plea bargain, sometimes they are dismissed outright. Doesn't it make sense that when you're told that, often in the same plea bargain, this can be used for purposes of sentencing, but this is going to be dismissed outright? And when you're told it can be used for purpose of sentencing, it is. And when you're not told it can't be, it isn't. I mean, isn't that simple? Doesn't that make sense? We don't have to then get into some kind of critical analysis about whether it's a difference in kind or only in reliability and the degrees and nuances of reliability. I mean, that's a problem for me. Can you respond to that?
No, the problem is that what you're saying is you want to put limits on what the judge can consider in sentencing based on what the defendant might understand the judge can consider in sentencing. And the answer to your problem is very simple, and that's just to tell him. Tell him what the judge can consider. We're going to dismiss this outright. That means you're not charged with it. You cannot be sentenced for it. But the fact that it is dismissed outright does not bind the judge to ignore it. The judge can still consider it.
That should be part of the plea colloquy, you're saying. Then they should.
That's a different question. I'm agreeing with you that the defendant should be told that. We have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. The defendant should be told that. This is what it means. It's dismissed means you're not charged with it anymore. You're not going to be convicted. You cannot be sentenced for it. You cannot be given a separate sentence for it. But the fact that it's dismissed doesn't bind the judge. The judge still can, if the judge wants to, consider that in sentencing. The defendant should be told that. Now, whether he should be told that as a part of the plea colloquy is a whole different question.
Fair enough. So you're saying the judge can use a dismissed outright for purposes of sentencing, for any purpose?
For any legitimate purpose. I'm not going to say any purpose, but the judge can use it. The judge can use any of this information, and I'm not going to limit it to dismissed charges. I'm not going to limit it to charges that are dismissed and read in. Any information that the judge can properly use, the judge can properly use for any of the purposes that are appropriate in sentencing, as long as that particular information is relevant to the purpose for which it is used by the sentencing court.
I'm just like Judge Brown said in the opinion of the Court of Appeals opinion, that it isn't clear to all what dismissed outright means or what the ramifications are when you have an attorney thinking one thing, a defendant thinking another thing, a judge thinking another thing. My tension in this case is this. Number one, I think a judge should have all of the relevant information to make the most informed decision at sentencing. I strongly believe that. But just like you started your argument this morning with what we refer to as a mea culpa.
Yes.
I, in serving as a circuit court judge for 10 years, thought during that tenure that dismissed outright meant the judge couldn't consider it because in the same plea agreement that say counts 1 and 3 are going to be dismissed outright, counts 4, 5, and 6 are going to be used as read-ins so that they can be considered at sentencing. And I sat there and I listened to that, and I heard the distinction. That distinction made sense to me, and that's the way that I implemented it without anyone saying to the contrary. And I think the attorneys in front of me argued it that way. I mean, they reinforced my understanding of it.
Yeah.
So
I don't doubt that you are not alone, that there are other people out there. There are other judges, there are other lawyers.
As we are.
There are other judges, there are other lawyers, perhaps defendants, who believe that a charge that is dismissed outright cannot be considered in sentencing. You cure that by making clear what Elias made clear many, many years ago, but apparently a lot of people have forgotten. You make that absolutely clear today that a charge that is dismissed outright can be considered in sentencing.
Or narrow Elias to its facts, as your opposing counsel is arguing.
I don't know if the Victim Crime Rights Act was in place when Justice Bradley was on the bench, but that adds an additional wrinkle. I, too, was on the bench for a decade, and that was a really important part of sentencing. Has victim crime rights been complied with? And the victims of the crimes have the right to speak and be there and say their piece. And if their case is being dismissed, they have the right to be consulted and let the judge know what they think of that. Now, I don't know how this rule would work, or is that unconstitutional? I mean, what do you do with victim rights?
Well, I think that prohibiting the judge from considering a dismissed charge has problems in many respects. First of all, I believe it violates the public policy that judges should be able to consider anything, and that the parties to the case, the district attorney and the defendant, should not be able to bind the judge not to consider certain information. And I think you're right, too. I think it does impact on victims' rights. Now, in this case, the mother of the girl who was the victim of the dismissed charge did appear at the sentencing and gave a very impassioned talk about how the fact that her daughter was sexually assaulted, despite the fact that the charge was dismissed, should be considered by the judge in sentencing Mr. Fry.
It's not uncommon.
It's not uncommon. No, you're right. It's not uncommon. And I believe that under our victims' rights provisions, there's a right to do that. And I think that's another facet of the problem with limiting the judge's consideration or ability to consider these dismissed charges.
There was a preliminary examination here.
There was, yes.
And did both of the sexual assault charges come up in the prelim?
Well, certainly for our purposes, the sexual assault involving Ariel, the one that was dismissed, that came up, and Ariel did testify at some length regarding what happened to her. So the judge did not just have an allegation in the complaint, something written out that the prosecutor said. The judge, the same judge, by the way, who did the sentencing, was at the preliminary hearing and saw Ariel testify as to what happened to her. So he did have that information. He had direct testimony, in addition to what Ariel's mother said at the sentencing.
Well, let me try to illustrate this graphically. Let's suppose I'm sitting as the trial judge, and I have a young woman over here testifying to a sexual assault, and I have a woman over there testifying to a sexual assault, and then one of the charges is dismissed outright. How can I just sort of erase that from my memory if there were a rule that required me to do so? I mean, how do you do that?
I think it would be very difficult to do that. Yes, I think it would be very extremely difficult to do that. If you're saying that at the very least the judge can say, well, I'm going to try my best to disregard the elephant in the room, that's standing right here, the elephant's still standing there. Yeah. And subconsciously, there's a very good chance that that's going to work its way into the sentencing, even if the judge says I can't consider it expressly.
So shouldn't the real issue be here, how do we prevent a defendant from being blindsided? So to speak.
I think the answer is we simply tell him, or we have somebody tell him. Now, I would frankly prefer that it be his lawyer who tells him this. I don't want to get into a whole other subject, but I will just say I think that colloquies are a good idea. between the judge and the defendant. But we can reach a point of diminishing returns. We can provide so much information that the computer just shuts down and none of it sinks in. My own personal preference would be that the colloquy cover only the most important points, the basic points, and that we leave it to the attorney who's talking to the defendant, who's talking to the defendant in kind of a quiet, removed setting. He's a person that the defendant has had contact with. They've been talking about the case, where they can discuss all these things. Here's what happens with a plea agreement. The DA has agreed to dismiss this charge. Now, here's what dismissed means. It means you're not charged with it anymore. You're not going to be convicted of this. You're not going to be sentenced separately for it. But the judge, if he wants, can still consider that in imposing the sentence for the charge to which you plead. Absolutely, the defendant should be told that, but I think he should be told that by the lawyer, because then the defendant can say, in his conversation, and I won't use the word colloquy here, I'll use the word conversation. In his conversation with his lawyer, he says, I don't understand that. How can the judge, if this charge is dismissed, how can the judge consider it in sentencing me for the charge to which I plead? And the attorney can explain it.
Should that conversation be reflected on the plea questionnaire?
I think it should be, yeah. I think there should be some documentation of it as to what was discussed. Because otherwise you get these defendants who come in and say, my attorney didn't tell me this, my attorney didn't tell me that, and blah, 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 blah. And in most cases it's a blatant lie, but they're just using it to withdraw the plea. It is. It is. but we should have documentation, yeah. Documentation as to what was discussed. We should have it in the plea questionnaire. This is what was discussed with me, signed by the defendant, witnessed by the attorney, so that the defendant knows. But I think that resolves the problems if we just tell the defendant, look, this is what dismissed outright means. Now, I got to tell you, I go back with this business. I used to practice before I joined the AG's office. I used to practice in Milwaukee when this whole business about read-ins kind of percolated up. You know, this was never a formal procedure. This just started out with some guys in the district attorney's office using this, saying, well, let's have it read in, and other people saying, hey, that's a good idea. And, it just sort of, it developed. It was the term that has been used, and I think very appropriately for stuff like this, is legal folklore. It's not something that is written into the law. It's not a statute. It's not a court decision. It's just kind of, what people start doing. And the thing is, the distinction that was made back then when we first started talking about this concept of reading in was that we used the term dismissed outright simply as the alternative to reading it in. Either read it in or was dismissed outright. It didn't have any, great formal legal meaning.
Except read in always was followed by so that it can be considered for purposes of sentencing.
Right.
I mean, it defined it.
Yeah.
That was part of the folklore, too.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I agree with you that the way the law has developed is kind of this informal development, and that's been a problem that people can misunderstand. But you can clarify that misunderstanding just by your decision today. You make a decision, and this is what read-in means, this is what dismissed outright means, and you tell a defendant what the two of them mean, and, problem is solved.
I think under State versus Wesley, Judge Brown's Court of Appeals decision, you pretty much have to tell, if you're going to make a distinction that's really in the law,
right.
You have to tell them, otherwise you're going to be subjected to all sorts of hearings for whether or not the plea was knowing and intelligent. That's what they did in Wesley.
We reversed. We, being the state, We want to avoid that, too. We want, if a defendant pleads guilty, we want that plea to stand. We don't want defendants withdrawing pleas, you know, five, ten years later, witnesses are gone, witnesses are forgotten. Very hard to retry these people. We want the plea to be valid, and we want the plea to stand up. So we want to do what needs to be done to make that plea valid.
The way I hear your argument goes, there's very little distinction, if any, for purposes of sentencing between a read-in and a dismissed, other than the judge's view about reliability. But there are other distinctions between the two. In fact, the way I hear you agree with the defendant that if it's dismissed as part of the plea agreement, that it would be a violation of the plea agreement if the state brought the charges again. Do you agree with that?
Well,
you keep saying the state can't bring them again in a dismissal.
There is a distinction between read-in charges and other charges that are dismissed but not read in as far as the district attorney's ability to refile those charges.
Right.
A charge that's read in as a matter of due process, it's not double jeopardy. There's no jeopardy that ever attaches here. But as a matter of due process, that kind of filters in the principles of double jeopardy, that charge cannot be brought again. That's out. Now, as far as a charge that's dismissed pursuant to a plea agreement, there is no legal principle that prevents the state from refiling those charges. Now, there are consequences to refiling those charges, but the state can refile them. The consequence being that if you refile the dismissed charge, that's a breach of the plea agreement, and the defendant can withdraw the plea. But there are circumstances, and I can attest to them, where a DA might want to do that.
Then your statement, various statements you've made, that to tell the defendant that dismissed charge, they will not be brought up again by the DA is too broad. And that's how you define dismissed charge, at least as I heard it. The other difference, or at least one other difference, is restitution.
Okay.
Can you get restitution on a dismissed charge?
Only if it's read in.
That's right. So that's
statutory.
Yeah, I understand
that's statutory.
It's statutory, I think, about the consequences of read in, but I'll have to go back and look at the statute. So if I can summarize your argument as I hear it, if it's a dismissed charge, and we're only talking about plea agreements here, not if it's dismissed without a plea agreement.
Right. All we're talking about is dismissed
right,
pursuant to a plea.
You have different agreement. Rules in other cases. If you've got a plea agreement and the charge is dismissed as part of that plea agreement, and the judge does dismiss that charge, it's the state's position that the judge may consider the dismissed charge for any purpose in sentencing, considering the reliability and value of this evidence of the dismissed charge. The state that the judge is not limited to character or pattern of conduct.
That's
Do we
correct.
Have to overturn any cases to say that?
Sorry?
Do we have to overturn any cases or explain or distinguish any cases?
You don't have to overturn any. That's for sure. But we do have this line of cases that, well, actually there are two propositions. One is the proposition that other acts, as it were, show a pattern of conduct. Some cases go further and say that this pattern of conduct is relevant to show character. No problem. No problem with either of those propositions. The problem comes in with a supposition that because this pattern of conduct is relevant to prove character, which is one of the course, one of the factors that a judge can consider in sentencing, that it cannot be used to consider other factors that can properly be used to consider other factors that can properly be considered in sentencing, such as the aggravated nature of the offense. Now,
so it's limited to character. Well, that's one line of cases.
Your cases don't say it's limited to character. Your cases just say it can be used for character. They don't say limited. Now, if they had said limited, then you might have an overruling problem. But they don't say limited. They just say it can be used for one purpose. So you can. That's all you have to do is explain that when we said it could be used for one purpose, we didn't mean it couldn't be used for another purpose.
So you want that expanded to make clear that it can be used for
any purpose you want. I would like that made clear, yes.
Okay.
And that is consistent. That's consistent with the whole public policy of allowing a judge to consider information at sentencing. It's just as much a violation of public policy, I think, to say that this information can only be used for one purpose but not another, as it is to say can't be used at all.
Well, the problem you get, and I agree the state doesn't want increased litigation any more than the defendant wants it, is you're going to then perhaps require the judge in sentencing to explain kind and degree. Don't use those terms, but we'll say, hey, this may not be very reliable, but I'm not using it for much,
no,
but
I don't think,
somewhat.
See, I don't think you have to go into that degree of detail. I think if you just tell the defendant it can be considered at sentencing, the judge can take it into account, that's enough.
I'm just talking about review of the judge's sentencing discretion. And when you review discretion, if the judge uses improper factors or gives undue weight to factors, that is...
Well, that's one of the problems. But we also have a line of cases that say that the weight to be given a particular factor is up to the judge, and it's only... If the judge is way off in left field somewhere and giving something that no reasonable judge could have given this amount of weight, the judge gives it that amount of weight, we say, you've erroneously exercised your discretion. But that's a problem that's inherent in any discretionary decision, not just sentencing. See, my red light is on. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Bellastrary. Ms. Lee?
I want to address the Chief Justice's question about how the court misused, if it did, the dismissed outright charge in this case. But I want to, if I may, address briefly the exchange I had with Justice Rogensack about why the state can't reinstitute charges that have been dismissed as part of a plea agreement. And the case that I was thinking of was State versus Comstock. In that case, this court said, we conclude that allowing the state to reinstate felony charges that had been dismissed outright with dismissed with prejudice as part of a plea agreement would amount to allowing the state to make repeated attempts to convict an individual for the same offense. Allowing that would violate the principles of finality and fairness underlying the double jeopardy clause.
But the statements in the case says dismissed with prejudice,
That's right.
I think is quite different than saying dismissed outright.
Right, and fair enough. And this court in that case went further on to say that subsequent re-prosecution of a charge dismissed as a result of a plea bargain is barred by elementary due process. So. And that was quoting Nelson v. State and also referring to Austin and then the U.S. Supreme Court case of Santabello. I just wanted to sort of clarify where I was coming from as to that issue. Now to address the other issue. The problem I have with what the court did here is that I see no distinction between how the sentencing court in this case treated the offense that had been dismissed as it would have with a read-in. If this case had been a read-in, it would have required the defendant to agree to have the charge considered. Whether he admitted it or not is irrelevant, but he would have had to agree to have the court consider it. Here, he did not agree to have the court consider it, and the court focused on it. Now, it was in the context of the defense attorney had submitted sentencing guidelines actually for second-degree sexual assault of a child, which this was not. The charge that was dismissed was not actually that offense, and the guidelines were no longer in use at the time of sentencing, but the sentencing court said, I'm just going to look at this. And the defense attorney had used it as a way of showing that the offense was mitigated. And what the sentencing court said is, you know, you're saying there wasn't intercourse. I find there was intercourse here. There was intercourse with Melissa, and there certainly was intercourse with Ariel. I think that goes above and beyond using that dismissed outright charge as a measure of whether this was an isolated event or a pattern of conduct, which is an index of the defendant's character. He also said, I find that force was used in these cases. Again, I think that goes above and beyond using the dismissed charge as a measure of the defendant's character. I think explicitly the court was using it as a measure of the seriousness of the offenses. I'm not alleging that the sentencing court was actually sentencing Mr. Fry on the dismissed charge. Clearly, it was not. But I think the fact that we can't come up with a distinction of how this charge was used versus how it would have been used as a read-in is problematic, because I think there must be a distinction. And that also goes to the questions I have about what the state wants this court to adopt. And that is that if we tell a defendant the court can use a dismissed charge for character or for the other elements, the other factors that the court must consider, what does that mean? Does it mean if the judge doesn't understand why this charge was dismissed because the sentencing court thinks it should not have been dismissed, which I think is probably what happened here, that it's going to give it great weight? I mean, the state argued that, well, it's a difference in degree because of the reliability and because of, you know, there's an assumption that a read-in will be given great weight. Well, this dismissed charge was given great weight at sentencing here. The sentencing court spent as much time talking about the dismissed outright charge as it did the charge for which the defendant had been convicted and for which the defendant was being sentenced. I don't think that makes sense, and I don't think that was fair to this defendant, because this is a defendant who would not have agreed to have a charge read in. This was the morning of trial. This was the second time the state had made this plea offer. We will dismiss that charge outright and others in exchange for your guilty or no contest plea to the charge regarding Melissa. It had been offered prior to trial. It was offered again on the morning of trial. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think that goes to the questions that Justice Prosser and Justice Ziegler raised about victims' rights. In this case, if the rule now were that dismissed outright charges cannot be considered at sentencing, I don't think the state would have offered. And it may not offer in future cases where you have a victim that wants to be heard, that needs to be heard, that has a right to be heard, that the state may not offer to dismiss charges. It may happen more often in cases where there's a battery and a disorderly conduct and the state says, plead to the battery and we'll dismiss outright the disorderly conduct. I mean, it may change the way that plea negotiations happen if the court adopts the rule that we're requesting. But at a bare minimum, I think that there needs to be a colloquy by the court. The defendant needs to enter a plea understanding exactly how a dismissed outright charge can be used. What are the parameters? As I've noted earlier, the problem with that rule is I think it's squishy. I think it's hard to define. I think it makes it almost impossible for a defendant to really understand what that means, as opposed to a read-in that's very clear. And I know that read-ins in Wisconsin started sort of casually in Milwaukee, but it actually stems from the common law of taking charges into consideration where you sort of come in and, you know, deal with everything in front of the defendant, and the court can then sentence the defendant based on full knowledge of the defendant. And again, barring a court from considering a dismissed outright charge doesn't immunize the information from the sentencing court, doesn't require the court to sentence someone with less than full information, because the court will have considered all that information about the defendant prior to allowing that plea agreement to go forward. So if the court thinks there's relevant information that it needs to consider at sentencing, it will not approve a plea agreement.
You agree with the state then that the information could be used more than for a pattern of conduct and character?
I don't think it should be. I think that it would be an expansion of what the current law in this state is to say that dismissed outright charges can be used for more than character. I think the cases, the way I read the cases, is that the law is that they're generally limited to that, to character. And of course, one of the issues is that it's up to the sentencing court to decide how much weight it places on one of the three factors. So if it decides to place all the weight on the defendant's character, then in essence it becomes a dismissed outright charge carries the same weight as a read-in charge.
Justice Prosser?
Would you preclude the writer of the PSI from discussing dismissed outright charges?
I think that would go hand in hand with the rule that it's not going to be considered.
Well, let's say we have a little girl who was sexually assaulted 10 times, and six of the counts are dismissed outright. How can you possibly the victim may be interviewed for the PSI. The circuit court might have heard a preliminary examination testimony. How can you possibly do that?
I think that what the PSI would discuss, obviously if there are 10 charges, we're talking about 10 separate incidences, they would have been charged separately in the criminal complaint. And I think the PSI would go into detail about those and would simply mention that other charges of the same nature had been dismissed. And I think that obviously the court would have some background information on those charges before it decided to approve the dismissal of those charges, because they would have been included in the complaint. I mean, and again, it may change the way that plea negotiations happen where there are more serious charges that are being sought to be dismissed outright. And it may be worth it to the state and to the victim and her family to have charges be dismissed outright in exchange for knowing that the defendant will be convicted for 4 of those 10 charges. And that may satisfy the victim and her family and spare her the trauma of going to trial. And, of course, the other issue that we haven't really discussed today, and I know that I'm out of time, is that with the change in preliminary hearings, what comes in also is going to affect the reliability of charges that are ultimately dismissed, because we're going to have different information coming in at those. So to the extent that that matters, I don't know. But that's how I would address the obviously valid concern about how we deal with victims, and in particular child victims, in cases such as these.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Lee, and thank you, Attorney Ballastrari, for yet another issue in a different form of what may be considered at sentencing and the significance of a plea agreement. That concludes our hearing in 10 AP 2801 CR, State versus Fry. The court will take a brief recess, so that the Horning High School students may leave if they wish, and another high school group may come. We are in recess.